This CosmicReality.com presentation is sponsored by MysticalWares.com. Is there something wrong?
Warning, life support failure on all decks. Abandon ship.
Maybe it is time to take command.
Bridge to captain.
Join Jan Shaw, updating current events as only Jan can.
Library computer. Data being received.
Produced by CosmicReality.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Cosmic Creating Show. It's the Wednesday edition and my name is Jan Shaw. I'm known as the Success Alchemist. You can find me at thesuccessalchemist.net, thewebalchemist.net, empoweredmanifestation.com, on Facebook and YouTube, Jan Shaw, the Success Alchemist, and on Twitter at Coach Jan Shaw. Today is the 6th of April 2022, and the title of today's show is The Walls Close In, The True Axis of Evil, Elon and Twitter, and anything else I have time for, which may not be much. Okay, so I want to start with what's going on with the Durham investigation, the Clinton campaign, and the current indictments. And when I go through the various articles on this subject, I think you'll agree that the walls are definitely closing in on Clinton and all the rest of the crew who basically conspired to try and prevent Trump from winning the 2016 election and then sabotaging his first term as president. So let's start with an article from Fox News. And the title is, Durham releases former Clinton lawyer Michael Sussman's text message, says he put lie in writing. And this was published yesterday, the 5th. Sussman had claimed he was meeting with FBI official not on behalf of a client. Special Counsel John Durham, in a filing late Monday, released what may prove to be a crucial piece of evidence in the case against former Clinton lawyer Michael Sussman, a text message he sent to the former FBI general counsel the eve of their September 2016 meeting, stating the same lie in writing that the information he would share would be not on behalf of a client or company. In a filing late Monday, Durham motioned to admit evidence for the Sussman trial, including a text message Sussman sent to then-FBI General Counsel James Baker. Durham contends that Sussman was in fact working for the DNC and the Clinton campaign at the time of the meeting. Durham's original indictment alleges that Sussman told then-FBI General Counsel James Baker in September 2016, less than 2 months before the 2016 presidential election, that he was not doing work for any client when he requested and held a meeting in which he presented purported data and white papers that allegedly demonstrated a covert communications channel between the Trump Organization and Alpha Bank, which has ties to the Kremlin. The indictment alleges that Sussman lied in the meeting, falsely stating to the general counsel that he was not providing the allegations to the FBI on behalf of any client. Durham, in his Monday filing, writes that Sussman had assembled and conveyed the allegations to the FBI on behalf of at least two specific clients, including Tech Executive One, who has been identified as Rodney Joffe, and the Clinton campaign. The tech executive has since identified himself as Rodney Joffe. Joffe is not named in Durham's filing and has not been charged with a crime. Indeed, on September 18, 2016, at 7:24 p.m., i.e. the night before the defendant met with the general counsel, the defendant conveyed the same lie in writing and sent the following text message to the general counsel's personal cell phone, Durham wrote in the filing. The text message, according to Durham, stated, Jim, it's Michael Sussman. I have something time-sensitive and sensitive I need to discuss. Do you have availability for a short meeting tomorrow? I'm coming on my own, not on behalf of a client or company. Want to help the Bureau? Thanks. Baker replied, okay, I'll find a time. What might work for you? Sussman responded, any time but lunchtime, you name it. The defendant's billing records reflect that the defendant repeatedly billed the Clinton campaign for his work on the Russian Bank One allegations, Durham wrote. In compiling and disseminating these allegations, the defendant and tech executive One also had met and communicated with another law partner at law firm One, who was then serving as general counsel to the Clinton campaign, campaign lawyer One. Sources familiar have told Fox News that campaign lawyer One is a reference to Mark Elias. Durham alleged that Sussman, Joffe and Joffe's associates exploited internet traffic about a particular healthcare provider, Trump Tower, Trump Central Park West apartment building, and the executive office of the President of the United States in order to establish an inference, a narrative tying Trump to Russia. Durham alleges that Sussman in February 2017 provided an updated set of allegations, including the Alpha Bank claims, and additional allegations related to Trump to a second US government agency, which Fox News has confirmed was the CIA. Durham also called for handwritten notes from then FBI officials, specifically the former Assistant Director for Counterintelligence and a former deputy general counsel, to be admitted as evidence for Sussman's trial. In handwritten notes about Sussman's meeting with Baker, purportedly belonging to the former assistant director for counterintelligence, Durham says the official wrote, said not doing this for any client. Similarly, the deputy general counsel took the following notes, which stated in part, no specific client, but group of cyber academics talked with him about research. Durham includes images of the handwritten notes in his filing. Durham is also motioning to admit Sussman's congressional testimony from December 2017. The interview was conducted under oath by then Chief Congressional Investigator for the House Intelligence Committee's Russia investigation, Kash Patel. In the line of questioning, Durham is requesting be admitted as evidence for trial. Patel asks Sussman if he engaged with the FBI and the CIA on his own volition, to which Sussman replied, no. Patel then asks Sussman if his client directed him to have conversations with the FBI and CIA, to which Sussman replied, yes. Patel asked if Sussman's clients knew he was going to the CIA to disclose additional information in February 2017, to which he replied, yes. Sussman also testified that he had a conversation with his client, as lawyers do with their clients, about clients' needs and objectives and the best course to take for a client. And so it may have been a decision that we came to together, Sussman testified. I mean, I don't want to imply that I was sort of directed to do something against my better judgment or that we were in any sort of conflict, but this was, I think it's most accurate to say it was done on behalf of my client. Meanwhile, Durham, in his filing late Monday, also motioned to admit a Clinton campaign tweet from October 31st, 2016. Durham does not specify which tweet he is requesting to be admitted. Durham could be referring to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's October 31, 2016 tweet stating, computer scientists have apparently uncovered a covert server linking the Trump Organization to a Russian-based bank. Clinton, in the tweet, also shared a statement from her campaign's senior policy advisor, Jake Sullivan, who now serves as President Biden's White House National Security Advisor. This could be the most direct link yet between Donald Trump and Moscow, Sullivan said in the October 2016 statement. Computer scientists have uncovered a covert server linking the Trump Organization to a Russian-based bank. Sullivan said the secret hotline may be the key to unlocking the mystery of Trump's ties to Russia. This line of communication may help explain Trump's bizarre adoration of Vladimir Putin and endorsement of so many Kremlin, pro-Kremlin positions throughout his campaign, he continued. It raises even more troubling questions in light of Russia's masterminding of hacking efforts, that are clearly intended to hurt Hillary Clinton's campaign. Sullivan added that they can only assume federal authorities will now explore this direct connection between Trump and Russia as part of their existing probe into Russia's meddling in our elections. A second Clinton tweet from that day stated it was time for Trump to answer serious questions about his ties to Russia. Clinton tweeted an image that states that Trump had a secret server to communicate privately with a Putin-tied Russian bank called Alpha Bank. Durham, in a footnote attached to the reference to the Clinton campaign tweet, states, "Currently, the government does not know what particular defences counsel plans to mount at trial. While it is plain from the defendant's motion to dismiss that he plans to make a materiality defence, the defendant may choose to raise other theories of defence as well." Durham continues, "Accordingly, the government's motions in limine here," I don't know what that means, L-I-M-I-N-E, "are intended to address evidentiary issues that might arise as part of various possible defence theories." So I just looked that word up, and it's pronounced in limine, and it's defined as, in US law, a motion in limine is a motion discussed outside the presence of the jury to request that certain testimony be excluded. Sussman's trial is scheduled to begin on May 16th, and it says this is a developing story. Check back for updates. The next piece of news, which doesn't do Hillary Clinton or the Clinton campaign any favours, is, this is from New York Post, Clinton 2016 campaign lawyer tech exec in quotes joint venture to smear Trump, Durham alleges. And the term joint venture has also been coupled with the word conspiracy. This article in the headline doesn't directly reference that word, but, you know, people are jumping on this, saying this is the first time that Durham has actually alleged a conspiracy relating to this in which Hillary Clinton was involved. So this is a great leap forward. And this is why I put in the title, "The Walls Close In." So let's get on with the article. Hillary Clinton's campaign, its lawyer and tech executive, took part in a joint venture to gather and spread dirt about Donald Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign, special counsel John Durham charges in a new filing. The bombshell claim was made in a 48-page motion filed late Monday, arguing for the admission of additional evidence ahead of Clinton campaign lawyer Michael Sussman's pending trial for allegedly lying to the FBI. At the heart of the case is a September 18, 2016 text message Sussman sent to then FBI General Counsel James Baker, which was reproduced in Monday's filing. And it does repeat some of the things that was in the previous article I just shared. In fact, prosecutors say Sussman, then a cybersecurity lawyer at powerhouse Democratic law firm Perkins Coie, had deceived Baker and was acting on behalf of the Clinton campaign when the two met the following day. That's in reference to the tweet saying that he was working on his own. During that sit-down, Sussman allegedly gave Baker information suggesting that servers at the Trump Organization were communicating with servers at Moscow-based Alpha Bank. That claim was amplified by the Clinton campaign to suggest that Trump was colluding with the Kremlin. According to Monday's filing, preparation for Sussman's meeting with Baker began in late July and early August when Tech Executive One, who has since been identified as Rodney Joffe, began telling employees at Virginia-based Newstar, where he was a senior vice president, to mine and assemble internet data that would support an inference or narrative tying Trump to Russia. Joffe, who is not named in the filing, allegedly said the point of the effort was to please these VIPs, which Durham says refers to Sussman, his Perkins Coie colleague Mark Elias, the Clinton campaign's general counsel, and the campaign itself. Prosecutors also alleged that Joffe ordered an executive at two other companies he owned to do a data deep dive into Trump, saying he was working with a person at a firm in Washington, D.C., with close ties to Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party. The document adds that Joffe even emailed the executive the home addresses, email addresses, IP addresses, and other personal information of various Trump associates, including spouses and other family members. According to Durham, the CEO was highly uncomfortable with Joffe's ask, but complied because he was a powerful figure, that's in quotes. The dive into Trump was given the code name Crimson Rhino. Eventually, prosecutors say Joffe and his associates exploited internet traffic relating to a healthcare provider to assemble information from Trump Tower and Trump Central Park West apartment building. Among the allegations made by Sussman were that Trump and his associates were using a type of Russian-made cell phone near the White House and other locations. At the same time, Sussman and Perkins Coie allegedly connected Joffe to Fusion GPS, the opposition research firm that hired former MI6 agent Christopher Steele to compile his now infamous dossier of explosive debunked allegations about Trump's supposed links to Russia. The most notorious of these claims was that Moscow security services possessed a tape of Trump in a Moscow hotel room with prostitutes who were supposedly urinating on a bed where Barack and Michelle Obama had previously stayed. The Clinton campaign kept quiet about its engagement with Fusion GPS, so quiet that last week the Federal Election Commission fined the campaign and the Democratic National Committee $8,000 and $105,000 respectively for mislabeling payments to the firm that were routed through Perkins Coie as legal advice and services rather than opposition research. According to the filing, Sussman even met with Steele himself, identified as UK Person 1, and Fusion GPS employees at Perkins Coie's offices in the summer of 2016. Prosecutors say that while Sussman told Congress in 2017 that he only meant to vet Steele, the one-time British spy testified under oath in a UK legal proceeding that Sussman shared the Alpha Bank allegation with him and Fusion GPS ordered Steele to research and produce intelligence reports about Alpha Bank. Allegations about the Trump Organization and Alpha Bank server ties also allegedly were shared by Steele with State Department officials, while Fusion GPS passed them on to at least one Department of Justice official. After these introductions were made, Durham alleges, Sussman and Fusion GPS employees shopped the Alpha Bank allegations to the mainstream media. The claims about the server traffic between Trump Tower and Alpha Bank were the subject of several contemporary reports ahead of Election Day 2016. The most notable story by Franklin Furr was published by Slate that October and bore the headline, "Was a Trump Server Communicating with Russia?" Finally, the Alpha Bank claims were allegedly compiled by Joffe and Sussman into a white paper that Sussman turned over to Baker when the two met. According to the indictment of Sussman, the lawyer billed the Clinton campaign for the time spent drafting the document. On the same day the Slate story about the Trump Organization and Alpha Bank came out, the New York Times reported that the FBI had looked into Sussman's allegations and concluded that there could be an innocuous explanation, like a marketing email or spam, for the computer contacts. According to the indictment, Sussman pursued the Alpha Bank angle even after Clinton's defeat by Trump in the 2016 election. In February 2017, he allegedly provided an updated set of allegations about the Russian bank and its relation to the Trump campaign to another US government agency that has since been identified as the CIA. Sussman was indicted in September 2021 and has pleaded not guilty to the charge of making false statements. Durham's motion seeks the admission of documents, including notes of conversations two other FBI officials had with Baker about his September 19, 2016 meeting with Sussman, emails involving Sussman, Joffe, Elias, Clinton campaign officials, and Fusion GPS employees, and deposition by Sussman before the House Intelligence Committee in December 2017. In that testimony, Sussman was asked if he was acting on his own volition when he contacted Baker and the CIA about the Alpha Bank allegations. He answered no. So did your client direct you to have those conversations? He was asked. Yes, he replied, before attempting to backtrack moments later. When you say my client directed me, we had a conversation, as lawyers do with their clients, about client needs and objectives and the best course to take for a client, he said. And so it may have been a decision that we came to together. I mean, I don't want to imply that I was sort of directed to do something against my better judgment or that we were in any sort of conflict. In a flurry of filings Monday, Sussman's legal team argued that much of the evidence sought by Durham was either inadmissible as hearsay or irrelevant to the charge against their client. The special counsel has not charged a substantive scheme to defraud the government, nor has he charged a conspiracy to defraud the government, one motion read. The manner in which the internet data was gathered, the objective strength and reliability of that data, and or conclusions drawn from the data, and the information that Christopher Steele separately provided to the FBI, all have no bearing on the only crime the special counsel chose to charge, whether Mr. Sussman falsely stated that he was not acting on behalf of a client when he met with Mr. Baker. Sussman's attorneys further accused Durham of trying to promote a baseless narrative that the Clinton campaign conspired with others to trick the federal government into investigating ties between President Trump and Russia. But there was no such conspiracy. The special counsel hasn't charged such a crime, and the special counsel should not be permitted to turn Mr. Sussman's trial on a narrow false statement charge into a circus full of sideshows that will only fuel partisan fervour. In a separate filing, Sussman's attorneys argued that the judge in the case should force Durham to offer Joffe immunity from prosecution or dismiss the case. While Mr. Joffe is prepared to testify in Mr. Sussman's defence and to offer critical exculpatory testimony on behalf of Mr. Sussman, including that Mr. Joffe's work was not connected to the Clinton campaign, the special counsel is making it impossible for Mr. Sussman to call Mr. Joffe as an exculpatory witness at trial, the document read. It is simply inconceivable that Mr. Joffe faces any real continuing criminal exposure in connection with the special counsel's investigation. The special counsel is yet again overreaching and doing so in violation of Mr. Sussman's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. The walls are also closing in on Hunter and Joe Biden, the whole Biden family. Of course, Joe Biden is denying any involvement in Hunter's affairs, but we have here from Blaze Media an article that was published today. Emails from Hunter Biden's laptop show that Joe Biden wrote a letter of recommendation for one of Hunter's Chinese business associates. Hunter Biden's infamous laptop continues to make waves following recent reports from the legacy media validating the authenticity of its contents. After obtaining emails containing correspondence between Hunter Biden and his business associates involved in a joint venture with Chinese investment firms Bohai Capital and BHR, Fox News reported that in 2017, Joe Biden wrote a college letter of recommendation for the son of one of Hunter's business associates. In the email dated January 3, 2017, Jonathan Lee, the CEO of BHR, said, "Gentlemen, please find the attached resume of my son, Chris Lee. He is applying to the following colleges for this year." According to the email, Lee's son was applying to Brown, Cornell, and New York University. Lee also attached an updated version of his son's CV in a subsequent email. In a subsequent email exchange, Hunter Biden's business associate, Jim Bulger, said, "Let's see how we can be helpful here to Chris." Several weeks later, in February 2017, Another business associate of Hunter's, Eric Schwerin, said to Lee, "Hunter asked me to send you a copy of the recommendation letter that he asked his father to write on behalf of Christopher for Brown University. The original is being FedExed to Dr. Paxson directly at Brown," Schwerin said. "It should be there by Tuesday at the latest, given Monday as a holiday here in the US. Let us know if you have any questions." The recipient of the letter is the president of Brown University. In response to Schwerin's message, Lee replied, "Hi, Eric, just seen the email. It is just great. Thank you very much. And Hunter, thank you very much too. All the best to you all." It is reportedly unclear if Lee's son attended or was even admitted to Brown University. When asked about these emails, White House Deputy Press Secretary Andrew Bates said, "We don't comment on the laptop." However, he did not deny the laptop's existence or repeat a previous claim from the White House that the laptop was Russian disinformation. A spokesperson from Brown University said that, "Because of privacy, we do not inquire of our registrar's office, admissions office, or any other office when we receive media requests such as these for information about applicants to Brown. Despite the apparent past involvement of President Joe Biden with his son's international business associates, the White House continues to deny that Biden had any knowledge of his son's business dealings." That was the end of that article, but I just wanted to say that despite that, there's more and more information coming out that the 10% for the big guy is definitely referring to Joe Biden, despite all the denials that are coming from the White House and particularly from Jen Psaki, who apparently now is leaving and going to be moving to MSDNC, which is probably a very appropriate place for her, considering that they only put out lies. Within the content of this article, there is actually a tweet from Curtis Hook about Peter Doocy, and he is a master of trolling the White House and Jen Psaki in particular. I'm just going to play it for you because this kind of sums it all up. The fact that they're in denial of all of this, but don't realise that that's futile given that all the truth is coming out.
Thank you, Jen. Two topics really quick. First, the president has said, and you have tweeted, that allegations of wrongdoing based on files pulled from Hunter Biden's laptop are Russian disinformation. There is a new book by a Politico reporter that finds some of the files on there are genuine. Is the White House still going with Russian disinformation?
I think it's broadly known and widely known, Peter, that there was a broad range of Russian disinformation back in 2020.
So there you have it, lying through her teeth again. It is despicable. So moving on to what I've termed the true axis of evil. Apparently it was a term that was that originated with George W. Bush in his State of the Union address in 2002. It describes foreign governments that during his administration allegedly sponsored terrorism and sought weapons of mass destruction. Of course, we know all that was fabricated. That was the excuse for going to war with Iraq. In this case, I'm really talking about this whole evil agenda, and I made a list of things that I consider to be part of this demonic attempt to take over the world. The sexualization of children, we've seen this in this revolt against DeSantis's law against the what is effectively the grooming of children. You know, the introduction of sex and gender and everything else to K through year three children. Ridiculous. We're talking about the murder of infants. There was a story released about the bodies of what appeared to be viable infants that had been aborted and killed in effect in a lab in DC, and it was obviously done for the harvesting of organs and fetal tissue. Although when we talk about fetal tissue, we normally don't refer to almost full-term babies. I mean, it has horrified people as to the fact that this has happened. We're talking about abortion laws that are being introduced that allow perinatal abortions, which in other words means after the full term birth of babies. And even Polis, the governor of Colorado, has just passed a law that allows any woman to decide to either, you know, carry the pregnancy to full term or not, with no limitation as to, you know, the when up to what point an abortion can be performed. So it's an open door to these horrific laws that basically are promoting the killing of unborn babies. Then we've got the transgender agenda, where children are being indoctrinated with the idea that they actually should be a different gender to the gender, the sex that they were born to. And they're promoting, and even in some cases, giving these children puberty blocking drugs without the knowledge of their parents. Now, if that isn't demonic, I don't know what is. And even Biden, on this Transgender Visibility Day, was promoting the use of transgender treatments for children. And, you know, if you can't have a drink until you're 21, if you can't have cigarettes until you're 21, if you can't vote until whatever, if you can't even drive a car until you're, what, 16 here, then why on earth are they allowing children younger than that to make decisions which they probably have, they definitely have absolutely no idea of the implications of it. I saw a tweet from somebody talking about student loans, demanding that Biden follows through with his promise to cancel student loans. And it was from somebody that said, you know, they'd signed this loan agreement at the age of 18 when they didn't really know what it meant. Well, if somebody can sign that at the age of 18 without knowing what it meant, how do you think it's possible for children to make a decision about whether or not they should change sex? I'm annoyed about this. You might have gathered that. And of course, then we've got associated with that this idea of making children over the age of 11 able to make their own decision about whether to take the kill shot. I mean, the other evil thing that's been going on, of course, is the mandating of the COVID bioweapon and the number of deaths that this is causing we've seen, and yet they're still not acknowledged. It's still being pushed. This is genocide. We're also looking at what I covered in last week's show on Saturday, this leniency towards child pornography, which this Ketanji Brown Jackson is saying is absolutely fine. And, you know, these people aren't necessarily pedophiles, with no concern whatsoever for these tortured and abused children who are the victims of the creators of this pornography. Then we've got the engineered inflation to really attack everybody who isn't earning millions of dollars, thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, there was that article in USA Today, I think it was, saying, oh, well, you know, if you earn less than $300,000 a year, then you need to eat lentils and, you know, cut down on this and cut down on that. I mean, talk about no out of contact completely with, you know, the actual workers here. Then we have this inflation, which is being denied. I can't remember who it was, but somebody was claiming that, well, if we ignore inflation, the economy is doing really well. This is, again, it's an economic weapon against the people. And overall, of course, we've got the Great Reset, and coupled with the Green New Deal, which is promoting vaccine mandate, social credit score, CBDC, which is central bank digital currencies. And I've mentioned this before, that this is happening across multiple countries, and it's a way of controlling how somebody, how a sovereign person can use their money. And it can be programmed to switch off that capability if the person concerned is deemed to be a radical, to oppose the, you know, the state agenda and so on. People need to wake up to this, because this is horrific. And I'm going to cover one or possibly two articles focusing on particularly this attack against children and families. And I'm going to start with an article from The Federalist. And this was published on the 4th, and the title is "The Left Unmasks Its Desire to Destroy Families and the Nation with Sexual Chaos." Florida Governor Ron DeSantis once again led the way in protecting parental rights in education last week when he signed into law a bill that prohibits age-inappropriate classroom instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity in kindergarten through third grade. The legislation also requires parental consent for any healthcare services offered at school, and school districts may not prohibit or discourage parental notification of or involvement in critical decisions affecting a student's mental, emotional, or physical health or well-being. Contrary to the fear-mongering, there is nothing controversial about this law. Yet it certainly does throw a spanner in the works for the radicals, neurotics, and degenerates in control of corporate America, the establishment media, and Hollywood, who are evidently on board with schools serving as platforms for perverts, predators, and groomers. The obscene obsession with hypersexualizing children that exploded about 2 years ago needs to be understood in the context of the left's wider agenda to promote moral relativism and sexual deviance, a campaign they have been gaslighting Americans into accepting as progressive. Decades ago, Marxists ditched class warfare and economics in favour of sexual politics and culture as a vehicle for executing revolution. Ever since, they have been shrewdly redefining marriage, family, sexuality, and gender, to the point where tolerance and diversity now means foisting porn, perversion, and predators on our families. Those who won't stand for it are cunningly condemned as bigots. Although the tactics have changed, the underlying objective is no different from the philosophy of their ideological forebears in communist hellholes like the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. The fundamental transformation of society by co-opting and perverting the nuclear family, the most influential societal unit and the bedrock of Judeo-Christian values. A nationwide trend, brainwashing school-aged children as young as 5 into becoming transgender-affirming disruptors of the nuclear family, is not just a thing happening out west in crazy California, Oregon, Colorado, and Washington State. In Virginia, Michigan, and Texas, parents have expressed disgust and outrage over sexually explicit materials in school libraries. In Connecticut, 8th graders were given a foul school assignment asking them to share their sexual desires in the form of pizza toppings. A couple in Florida accused their 12-year-old daughter's elementary school of covertly coaching her in gender confusion, which they believe led to her suicide attempt. After last year's gubernatorial election in Virginia, Democrat Terry McAuliffe learned the hard way that parents don't want this trash for their kids. It turns out white suburban women don't take kindly to school boards covering up the brutal rape of a 14-year-old girl by a gender-fluid student. Then there's the Wisconsin teacher who apparently used a link in her email signature block to redirect students to an LGBT resource site and sex toy shop. And the Missouri teacher charged with sending dozens of nude photos and videos of himself to students, including a girl under 15. Against this stunning backdrop, the US Senate is poised to confirm the catastrophic Biden administration's Supreme Court nominee a radical judge with a 25-year career history of leniency toward individuals convicted of possessing or distributing child pornography. The left-wing media was quick to normalize and defend this disturbing trend, while endeavoring to humanize the depraved pedophiles in question. A recent op-ed in The Hill spelled out the horrific reality behind the euphemistic phrase child pornography. It is the recording of violent acts of torture committed against terrified, defenseless, prepubescent children and even infants by adult men and distributed for the sadistic pleasure of the sickos who consume it, perpetuating a fiendish and expanding industry. The shift to cultural Marxism. From the classroom floor to the Senate floor, none of this is a coincidence. Over the course of the 20th century, cultural Marxists realized that the class warfare narrative was never going to lure enough Americans to achieve a fundamental transformation of this nation. Despite the Soviet Union directing and subsidizing communist infiltration of US government agencies, trade and teachers' unions, and even churches and seminaries beginning in the 1930s, classical Marxism proved a flop. The left's tactical response was twofold. Firstly, in reimagining Marxism in terms of sex and culture, they used maneuver warfare to simply attack the Hill from a more advantageous position. Secondly, pushing the falsehood that the Red Scare was just a conspiracy of the early 1950s deluded Americans into thinking the communist threat was a hoax when, in truth, it never went away. Meanwhile, whether the battleground is economics or culture, the greatest threat to the twisted Marxist ideology has always been the Christian family. Christians know, as St. Paul writes, that every family in heaven and on earth receives its true name not from the state or a party or society or some fanciful village, but from God the Father. Hence the repression of religious families, the laicization of schools, and the prohibition of religious education that began with the Bolsheviks. In the 1950s, under the Khrushchev regime, Nikolai Ilyichev, the chief ideologist for a reinvigorated anti-religious propaganda blitz, summed it up well when he stated that in Soviet society, a family is a cell of communist education or a refuge of backward conceptions. The left's contempt for those who remain faithful to God's commandments and the truth revealed by Christ has never changed. With your eyes clear, stand up and fight. Resisting the soul-destroying lies being force-fed to innocent children means supporting candidates who fear God more than some punk journalist and who are bold enough, DeSantis-style, to stand up to the Marxist schemers waging this cultural revolution. The politically suicidal Republicans and moderate Democrats flirting with the idea of supporting a historically unpopular Biden administration's pedo-lenient Supreme Court pick might want to simultaneously start researching their post-political career options. The end of the article talks about religious stuff, and I'm not a fan of organized religion, so I'll leave that part out. To me, it's just another form of government and control. But what the article is saying is definitely what we're seeing in terms of this agenda playing out. And anyone who opposes it is being gaslighted as being transphobic, homophobic, and a conspiracy theorist. And you can see it in the headlines that are coming out at the moment in relation to this nomination or confirmation of Ketanji Brown Jackson, basically saying those people who are objecting to her, saying that we have an epidemic of child pornography, are just conspiracy theorists. So what people are saying is it's really indicative of which politicians actually support child pornography and potentially pedophilia. So we'll have to see. Unfortunately, it's looking like she's going to be confirmed, which to me is an absolute disaster. I also want to share with you this article from The Good Citizen, and it's a Substack site, thegoodcitizen.substack.com. Title is Get Them Young. This was published April 2nd. Now, it's quite a long article, so I might not be able to share the whole of it. I'll have to keep an eye on the clock so I don't run out of time. But let's go and let's see how far I can get. So far, I've only written one piece on social justice, our race back into the cave. This is an unplanned post that's also personal. The topic is too important not to share. There are experts who are focused on exposing the grooming of children in schools and are activating parents and politicians to fight back. The most notable person is, of course, James Lindsay, PhD. He's the co-author of Critical Theories, Social Injustice, Race Marxism and Counter-Wokecraft, and the founder of New Discourses. There are useful articles and videos on New Discourses. I'll be including one video at the end related to the topic of the Marxist history of sex education. If you are a parent with children in public or private schools in the US, Canada or the UK, and you want to protect your children or grandchildren from abusers and groomers, his books are a good place to start after first getting your kids away from the groomers, of course. It's not always easy to recognise them, though. They aren't all wearing nose rings and they don't all have pink or blue hair. Don't think living in a red state or sending them to private school is enough to shield them. These monsters are everywhere and include school board members and school administrators. Child abuse and grooming. There are many forms of child abuse beyond the physical or psychological abuse of a parent or guardian to a child. This might be considered old school child abuse and is still prevalent and pernicious. The idea that children need protection from harmful and abusive parents by the state still holds. However, over the last decade, this has become inverted by ideologues who believe they know better than parents how to raise their children. For years now, children have become victims of a new form of child abuse that's rooted in completely made-up academic disciplines relating to critical theories. The most well-known has become critical race theory, CRT, which teaches a warped and racist view of race relations based on blood guilt and the historical crimes of one race for which descendants of the same race must atone for the sins of their ancestors. Teaching children that the colour of their skin is paramount and to view the social relations with their peers based on oppression and privilege is nothing short of blatant child abuse. To do the same with radical gender or queer theories with young children is blatant grooming. We often think of grooming in those old school terms as physical contact or sexual abuse by monsters. The vast majority of grooming is psychologically driven, making children confused about complicated and private subjects like gender and sexuality, particularly without the consent of parents, is an insidious new practice that educators believe is their duty and responsibility. There are monsters everywhere in society, many with criminal records and registered on sex offender lists, whom you wouldn't let your children near, and yet in school classrooms across the US, this is mostly an American phenomenon, though Britain and her Commonwealths are trying to keep pace, parents allow their children to spend 6 to 8 hours each day with activist monsters who prey upon their vulnerable children, confusing them about sexuality and gender, and this being the age of epidemic narcissism, often sharing far too much information about themselves and their own sexuality and gender confusion with children as young as 3. This practice hit home personally a few years ago when I was with my 6-year-old niece and 4-year-old nephew. Driving them home one day, we passed a pond of geese and my niece spoke of male geese and female geese. We talked about the goose and the gander. Then she asked, "How come with geese there are only he and she geese, but with us we can have more than just 2? Again, she was 6 years old at the time and I was visiting for the first time since she was 3. I nearly drove into a ditch. When I asked where she learned that, she said school. They live near the one city in the US you would imagine as being the centre of all this ideological madness. Yeah, that one. To say I was furious is an understatement. That was before child abuse with masking, social distancing and school closures. Both kids had 2 years of their lives stolen from them by teachers' unions and a psychotic woke butch governor. They didn't even return to school until a month ago. They just got to remove their masks in school a week ago. one of their new facilitators, teachers, is a genderqueer something-something, basically a man who wears dresses. Their indoctrination into this madness is now on overdrive, and as their uncle who lives on another continent, there's not a damn thing I can do about it, which is partly why I still live on another continent. It's too painful to watch up close. How did we arrive at this point where activist teachers, many of them clearly mentally ill, get to groom children as young as 3 years old in classrooms under the guises of diversity and inclusion, or tolerance and acceptance, or creating safe spaces for marginalised groups? How does Western civilization get to the point where the children are the property of the state to be raised by the state? Grooming, the deliberate act of bringing a child into a sexual, political, or racial ideology, practice, cult, or lifestyle without the knowledge or consent of his or her parents, for the aim of isolating them from their family so the external party can abuse and manipulate them. How do parents in blue states put up with this madness? Are they not complicit in the abuse and grooming of their own children? Not if they've already been assimilated into the cult themselves. If they believe in the aims of the agenda, they will do some brainwashing of their own when they aren't giving their blessing to the teachers. It will simply be reinforced by the parents. Excerpt from the New World Order 1989 book I included in the last piece, The Family. Parents will not be allowed to raise their children, the state will. And then there's a screenshot of a Daily Wire heading, article heading, White House, early trans surgeries, hormones are crucial for kids, teens who identify as trans. This was, of course, Biden on his Trans Visibility Day. As with most cults, the LGBTQT cult has its symbols, tenets, groupthink language, special days of celebration, orthodoxies that require strict adherence. And those who don't submit and obey are labelled heretics, transphobes, homophobes, etc. Apparently yesterday was Trans Day of Visibility, just one of the many LGBTQT days of celebration, each of which will be another opportunity for grooming children in classrooms. Dr. Matt Walsh, women's studies scholar, tweets, "It's a good thing that we have a Trans Day of Visibility, because aside from this day and Pride Month, an International Pronouns Day and Lesbian Visibility Day, an International Day Against Homophobia and Harvey Milk Day and Pansexual and Panromantic Visibility Day and Bisexuality Day and Bisexual Awareness Week and National Coming Out Day and National LGBT Centre Awareness Day and Spirit Day and Intersex Awareness Day and Asexual Awareness Week and Transgender Day of Remembrance and Pansexual Pride Day and Aromantic Spectrum Awareness Week and Omnisexual Visibility Day and Non-Binary Awareness Week and Transgender Parent Day and every other day and hour and minute of our lives, we really don't celebrate the LGBTQ community enough. If you want to see this cult perform daily and understand just how deep the rot goes in education, the Twitter account Libs of TikTok is one of the best. Here's a compilation of Libs of TikTok videos just from one day featuring some grade school teachers, including one first grade teacher who is sad that she can't share her sexuality, girlfriend or private life with her students. I don't know about you good citizens, but I can't recall a single teacher from 12 grades of public schooling in the US ever sharing a single word about their private lives, ever. Because teachers simply weren't raging narcissists back then. So I don't have time to go through all of these, but I'll just go through the key points here. The Hampton School District in Virginia has passed a set of guidelines that say teachers can change a student's gender without telling the parents. That's a Twitter thread from the account at Wokal Distance. The excuse for this rule is, of course, safety. The woke think that not letting people, even five-year-olds, change genders is harmful. Anything other than affirming a new gender is seen as abuse. Then the following is a Twitter thread from the account at Josh Dawes, who is the host of the Great Awakening podcast. I'm seeing a lot of people on the right share this meme, "The left just want to diddle your kids." While it may be a strong satirical response to those who get lost in nuance, it fundamentally fails to recognise why the left wants to talk to your kids about sexuality. The left doesn't want to diddle kids, they want to create little revolutionaries. To do that, they need to sever the bond between students and the parents they believe are raising their children to be hateful bigots. I'm going to jump down to near the bottom. This says what to do. Get involved in your local school district, preferably school boards. Move to a different district or find a different school nearby where you can move your children that isn't swamped by ideological groomers. Move to a different state where all other measures fail. Homeschool your children if possible. Don't vote for far-left ideologues, progressives, or even liberals or Democrats. That entire side of the political spectrum has embraced this madness. Local elections always matter most, so get to know the candidates from sheriff to city council, and especially those running for county school boards. In this coming midterm election, there are a lot of open school board seats, but registration to get on the ballot is often months in advance. Links to counties in most states here. If they require a political party and you're not registered with a party, simply write not woke party so voters know why you're running. Okay, so I haven't got much time left. I just want to cover this last topic, which is Elon Musk and Twitter. Blaze Media reports Elon Musk appointed to Twitter board immediately teases edit button and other significant improvements. And this was from yesterday. And the background is that he put out a poll on Twitter asking if people thought that Twitter was supporting free speech. And about three quarters of the respondents said no. And this was just before he purchased a 9.2% stake in Twitter to become the company's largest individual shareholder this week. Tech billionaire and noted Twitter critic Elon Musk is now set to join the company's board of directors. In a Securities and Exchange Commission filing on Monday, the company announced its intention to appoint the Tesla founder and CEO to serve as a Class 2 director with a term currently set to expire in 2024 at the company's annual stockholders meeting. As part of the agreement, Musk is prohibited from becoming the owner of more than 14.9% of the company's common stock. Twitter CEO Parag Agrawal also announced Musk's addition to the board in a pair of tweets Tuesday, saying, "Through conversations with Elon in recent weeks, it became clear to us that he would bring great value to our board." Agrawal seemed to welcome Musk's appointment, noting he is both a passionate believer and intense critic of the service, adding, "which is exactly what we need on Twitter and in the boardroom to make us stronger in the long term." In recent weeks, Musk has become more outspoken in his criticism of the social media platform, known for its blatant censorship of voices that stray from the progressive left-wing dogma. Last month, he posted a poll on the platform asking users whether they believed it was adhering to the principles of free speech, and users responded with a resounding no. Later, he suggested that he was putting serious thought into starting a new social media company that would rival Twitter. Musk's new platform suggestion elicited a raft of responses from users, many of whom implored the billionaire to buy Twitter and make it better. I'm not going to read the rest of this, but the other things to know are that people are asking for Musk to reinstate Donald Trump's Twitter account. But there's also questions about whether he is controlled opposition. I've had very mixed feelings about him. He's known to have been one of the WEF, World Economic Forum's young leaders, and also promoting putting chips in people's brains. So is he part of the transhumanist agenda? It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, but I'm not suggesting that Elon Musk being influential on the Twitter board is really going to make that much difference. People have said that the blocking of the Babylon Bee after they posted this tweet about Rachel Levine being a man, being man of the year. Apparently Elon Musk is a fan of Babylon Bee and he was not happy when they got blocked on Twitter. But we'll have to see how this plays out, because obviously if free speech is reinstated on Twitter, that will be a great step forward. But we must remember that Agrawal, the new CEO, has been even more draconian against free speech than even Jack Dorsey was before he abruptly stepped down. So that's all I have time for today. I think one thing we need to focus on is the fact that this is an avalanche of information that's being exposed about the criminality and the demonism of these people. So it's making a lot of people very angry and really wake up to the reality of what's been happening on this planet for so long. So good signs. Trump put out an amazing speech on Saturday. I haven't covered that, but it was very inspiring that he was going to be doing something soon. So I'll have to wait and see. So thank you for listening. Thank you to Nancy for producing. I hope you'll enjoy me for my next show on Saturday. And finally, thank you to Derek Condit from mysticalwares.com for sponsoring the Cosmic Reality radio station and making all this possible. Take care, be safe, and bye for now.
You have been listening to Cosmic Creating with Jan Shaw, updating current reality, a production of cosmicreality.com.
Thank you for listening to Cosmic Reality Radio. We appreciate your support. Please visit our sponsor at mysticalwares.com for our huge selection of metaphysical products, gifts, candles, incense, and one of the largest shungite collections available.
Cosmic Reality Radio is sponsored by Mystical Wares online store, where coupon code SAVE10 will get you 10% off your entire order at mysticalwares.com.